This is Mind Frame, a podcast of mind-bending science fiction. I'm Dave Moten, the narrator, host, and author of Mind Frame, and with me, silently judging as usual, is my producer extraordinaire, Brent Van Tassel, who makes everything possible. We are embarking upon Chapter 31, which is going to get us back into the story of Desi Arnaz. But before we get there, just a quick reminder that we are a Podbelly original. If you love podcasting, if you're looking for new podcasts to listen to, that's a great place to go. Podbelly.com. You can find tips and tricks on how to podcast, as well as a list of other podcasts that you can listen to and download either through Podbelly or through wherever you get your podcasts in general. Also, we want to thank our patrons. You mean the world to us. You help keep me inspired to continue writing chapters, and you help us to be able to afford server space and to send stuff out through the mail and all sorts of daily business that has to happen on the backside of podcasting. So if you really like what you're listening to and you want to support the show, a great way to do it is to go to patreon.com/mindframepodcast. For just a dollar, you get all of our bonus episodes, which are our sit-downs. And with the sit-downs, it's myself and Brent and Zach Smith, and we talk about all the behind-the-scenes stuff behind each chapter. We talk about writing process. We go on tangents about science fiction. We talk about the mysteries in each chapter, etc. So it's really its own second podcast behind the podcast, and you can get that for just a dollar at MindFrame, and you can get other rewards for other prices. So go to patreon.com/mindframepodcast if you are interested in becoming one of our patrons. So, where we last left Sophie Arnaz, she had just, in the Mind Frame version, murdered Marcellus Ball, and she snuck his body out in an invisibility suit along with the German Fry, even though they got busted by the Admiral in mid-escape. And as she made a mad dash towards something called the Lamb Tin, she really didn't know where she was going or what the plan was, but she had discovered the Lamb Tin as a ship that she was flying toward. So with all of that as a reminder, we hope you enjoy this chapter of Mind Frame. Chapter 31, Sophie Arnaz, 2142. Home. Arnaz knew she was leaving home. Years ago, when she finished her aptitude tests, she was assigned to be a trickster pilot. That meant she had the best reflexes, instincts, and skills in order to fly that fighter craft and engage in dogfights with the deviant enemy. And fight she had. Battles against deviants were more common than she'd have assumed. The brass assured them that the total number of deviants was low, but that their training and battle willingness was high. If 9 out of 10 deviants fought, it meant a very large army, compared to the 1 in a million combatants of World Navy. While learning how to shoot down deviants, part of the training was a love of the homeland. A common saying was, a homesick pilot is a dedicated pilot. That old yarn helped emphasize that Earth was your home, and you would be away from it during your service. This mindset, longing for home, seemed to serve the reconditioning of basic World Navy training. Earth is home. She is worth defending. You badass few will defend her and keep her in your heart like a song. The longer version of the saying was a chant they'd be made to scream while marching. When the mission is done, when the lariat is open, when the deviants fall, when all that remains is democracy, only then will we return home. But for Arnaz, not so much. Her mind didn't work that way. She easily altered what she thought of as her home. Growing up, San Pedro, California was her home. Then, seemingly overnight, the World Navy Academy. Then the Orbital Flight School on the Atlantis Space Elevator. Finally, the spherical behemoth known as the Naval Theater of Operations Echo became her home. She would hang her bag, dock her trickster, meet her bunkmates, and have a home. NTO Echo was especially comfortable to her, but that was only after Admiral Oshiro allowed her to start visiting Marcellus in the framing chamber. No need to create a new, albeit temporary, family for your new temporary home when you already had a loved one right there with you, serving on the same platform. But at the moment, Oshiro was dead. killed by Fry's suicide explosion, and Sophie's loved one was in the back seat. Arnaz was leaving that home for the last time ever, curious where her mission took her next and what her next polymorphing notion of a house would be. It could be anything from a mining colony to Earth herself, since deviants were allegedly everywhere. Arnaz sat in the cramped pilot's seat of the little people mover that she had just jettisoned from the Naval Theater of Operations Echo. The wide canopy to the front showed the whole of the Lam Tim in front of her. The light cargo haulers like this were churned out more than any other ship, since more and more of humanity lived in the vast expanse of the solar system. Everything from foodstuffs and soil to machine parts and smaller craft would be patiently moved by the LCH class, from one side of the solar system to the other. To call them light was a bit of a misnomer, however. They were fairly large ships. The chassis of the main vessel looked like a rod, with a bridge at the top and a fluted engine structure at the bottom. They were matte black due to the nature of their hull's material, and they were designed to have 12 cargo units attached to them. The curved cargo units were shaped like a third of a donut each. All three would connect to the surface of the ship, lining up to cover the circumference equator of the cylinder. This would happen four times up and down the shaft of the ship, making it look like it doubled in size due to the cargo containers. The containers were each about the size of a large warehouse found on the docks of a coastal city on Earth. They were the same dull black color as the ship itself, but they each had a massive glowing blue sigil on the hull that meant what type of cargo was inside. There were roughly 50 sigils that were beamed down along with the plans for this class of ship. They each meant something like temperature controlled, or no atmosphere, or artificial gravity. They'd combine with other symbols like radioactive, or perishable, or living organism to tell people what was inside at a cursory glance. Only 38 of the 50 symbols made any sense, the other 12 indicating some sort of cargo Earthlings were still unaware of. While she waited for the cargo ship to let her people mover dock, Sophie removed the clear plastic glove of her camouflage blimp suit so she could reach her uniform beneath. She then rolled up the sleeve of her naval blacks to reveal the skin of her left forearm. She did the three-finger swipe that her Skinner face recognized, and the last item she had viewed materialized in a burst of freckles. It was the checklist. Now she had time to update it and evaluate. 1. Infiltrate Marcellus Ball's framing chamber. Check. 2. Give Ball the chance to defect and make own decision. Check. Failure, but check. 3. Await arrival of the German. Check. 4. Follow the German's lead to evacuate the inner shell of Naval Theater of Operations Echo. Check. The German was a casualty, but again, check. 5. Find escape ship. Check. 6. Board escape ship. She didn't check that one since they were still doing the docking dance. 7. Escape NTO Echo's pursuit fleet. A big fat no check there. It was frankly inconceivable to get away. 8. Secure Ball in framing chamber. No. 9. Debrief mission leader. Definitely no. Who was the mission leader? Not the German? And regardless, number 7, how are they supposed to escape a fleet designed with the relentless military purpose of stopping single ships and small deviant fleets from escaping? She said out loud, "Faith in the plan, Desi. Faith in the plan. Bigger britches than you have been planning this mission since before you joined the Academy." She instantly felt silly for saying it out loud, and then not so much because she realized she was probably only saying it to Marcellus, who was strapped in and unconscious in the seat behind her. The Lam Tin's grappling arms took a hold of Arnez's people mover as the docking began. She was no longer under her own thrust and was being pulled into one of the modular cargo pods. The people mover spun suddenly, showing a view of the Echo's dark outer shell, then deep space. A few seconds later, the black of space started to fade to gray, the effects of lights near her position. Stars seemed to blink out as light pollution from the inside of the cargo container took over. Suddenly, a hatch was rolling from the right, a disc of metal that popped into place, eliminating the view of any stars at all. They were inside the Lam Tin. 20 seconds until normalized pressure, the people mover's voice said. Then, 30 seconds until 1/4 gravity. She looked back over her shoulder into the cab of the people mover and checked on Marcellus. He was still sound asleep, draped in his ridiculous billowing blimp suit, Irwin and Barca hovering patiently above. Pressure, the voice said, and a few seconds later, Arnez felt the scrape of the seat below her instead of the pull of the harness, as gravity had been artificially created. Or, as the messengers assured them, something that was not gravity, but could reproduce similar results had happened in the plating on the floor of the Lambton's cargo bay, where they were now stored. The computer confirmed this by saying, 1/4 gravity. This was a big moment for Arnez. She had never considered herself a deviant. She was just paying back favors that were done to let her get into the academy and to get her half-assed ex-boyfriend of 7 years ago to do labor in Atlantis instead of time in an actual prison. Of course she saw flaws in WorldGov, in the voting system, in the blind faith of opening the Lariat. Any critical thinker would. But she also saw the most educated, well-fed, peaceful human beings in the history of the species. The system wasn't fair to everyone, but could any system ever be? It didn't matter now. She was a deviant. She had lied to the World Navy, kidnapped one of the most powerful framers alive, and was implicit in the death of 2 naval officers. She was on board a deviant ship, and she was about to meet her deviant crew. She heard a heavy piece of metal bang against the hull of the people mover 3 times. She thought it was more noise from the docking procedure, but then realized it was a human being knocking. A brief pause, and then the back hatch to the mover was opened from the outside. A short, tan man with a wild head of black curly hair and a thick-cropped beard stood at the hatch. For every crazy hair out of place on his head, there was one in perfectly cut harmony on his face. He wore the red jumpsuit of a naval cargo mover, but the shirt portion of the suit was unzipped, the sleeves tied around his waist. It gave the effect of a heavy, bright red pants with a very strange, oversized belt. He wore a muscle shirt, which was brimming with chest, arm, and body hair. The man was a bear. He held a wrench so massive as to look like a comedic prop. What it wrenched, Arnez could not fathom. She unbuckled and squeezed out of the control space. She stood hunched in the back of the people mover. Sophie Arnez, she started, then shook her head and corrected herself. Desi, requesting permission to come aboard with Marcellus Ball and 2 attendant droids. Permission granted, but only to the humans, the short man said, backing away. Another man stepped in front of the hatch from outside. He was a full head and shoulders taller than the hairy one. He wore a mismatch of military clothing, a dash of Marine, a dash of World Police, a dash of World Naval uniform, and a dash of denim. He had a bandolier filled with clips of some strange ammunition and currently held a sword that was skinny with a round pommel. It rested against his shoulder. His head was perfectly bald, his face heavy and well-worn. He looked to be in his 60s and had an elaborate Van Dyke beard that looked freshly waxed at the mustache. A firearm the size of a sawed-off shotgun was holstered on his left leg, and the sheath for this odd, modified vibro sword was on his right. The bald, weaponized man said, "I think it's the captain's purview to fully welcome you on board, Desi, and she's currently at the helm, but feel free to crawl on out of there. Need help with the, him? No, thank you. I've got him." The other man's voice came in from the cargo bay. "Just you two. The death bots stay here in the pod, at least until we can eject said pod into deep space where they are free to do whatever they want." "They are mission critical, Collis," the bald man said. "They normalize and stabilize him, and while he's transitioning away from his frame at Echo Station, they'll be the only thing that keeps him sane." "Like any of them are fucking sane," muttered the short man, apparently called Collis. The bald one added, "Moreover, they will kill every single one of us in a matter of seconds if we attempt to separate them from their framer. You've apparently never seen one of these beauties weaponize." He stood to the side and moved his arm with a flare to welcome Desi on board. She pushed out the gurney, and Collis gave a downright evil look at the 2 attendants. "Fry, If you would come out and settle up our bet, please, I believe you owe me... The Baldwin cut himself short. He read the room. Desi's expression said it all, but he poked his head deeper into the people mover to see that the German named Fry wasn't there. How'd it go? He asked Desi. Strange way to word it, but she knew him to mean, how did Fry die? He had a device on him, incineration. It was instant. Admiral Oshiro walked past us and somehow triggered Marcellus's frame. She saw me even through the invisible suit, put things together. She was readying weapons. She was going to shoot me, Marcellus, probably. The world was flickering in and out between reality and the dream. Fry ran over towards her, yelled out the name of this ship to me, and the Admiral? Collis asked. The Admiral and the Colonel in charge of security were both inside the blast radius. Collis screamed out a woo-hoo and banged his massive wrench on the floor several times before throwing it dangerously in a random direction. Bucking Fry takes their best framer and then rubs out two top brass all in one pop. You better be worth it, sweetie, Collis said, pointing towards Marcellus. You better be worth it. The man walked off to the front of the Lamb Tin. I'm Durkin, the tall man said with a bow as he sheathed his sword. Welcome to our lovely little ship, the Apple of Discord. I'm sworn to protect our framer, Iffy. Iffy's the one who's still keeping the entire Echo Fleet from swarming down upon us. Let's secure Lieutenant Ball in a chamber, and then we'll go get to meet the captain. Then we'll make our daring escape. Come. Time, for the moment, is not an ally. Desi, and she had to get used to calling herself that after a life in the Navy being called only Arnez, walked behind Durkin. This particular cargo unit was mostly empty, she noticed. On the inside of the ship, each cargo pod was sealed off from the rest of them. This was so that something radiological or frozen wouldn't interact with atmosphere of the others that were being hauled. This particular cargo pod held maybe half a dozen shipping containers of differing sizes. Desi couldn't remember all the shipping container designations from her academy days, but she thought the smallest of them was a G container, 15 by 15 feet. The others were larger. She assumed the rest of the ship was filled with cargo or deviant pirates or secret weapons, but the honest truth could have been that the entire ship was meant to have only Marcellus Ball as its cargo. Desi followed Durkin to the nearest G container. He opened up a hatch and stood to the side so she could wheel Marcellus in. The inside of the container had a basic low-gravity toilet and sink, a bunk, and some ration packs. The walls were lined with the same white stuff that lined the walls of framing chambers. But instead of the perfect, factory-produced smooth walls by WorldGov, it was a handmade affair that looked like children made it with clay. The walls were lumpy, uneven, and still showed where thumbs made impressions in the framing of it. It was very much like the surface tiles of her blimp suit. Durkin came in as Desi was starting to take the blimp suit off of Marcellus. Durkin said, No, leave it on. They're searching for him, not us. Ife is still making him invisible to their systems. Plus, the captain needs you like 5 minutes ago. Before leaving the ersatz framing chamber, Desi stripped her own blimp off, felt the wind inside the suit go away, and instantly missed it. It was disconcerting removing the large needles, not feeling it as they slid out of her flesh, leaving neither a puncture wound nor blood. She tried her best to fold the strange thing, giving up mid-process. Durkin reached out and took it from her, tossing it out of the shipping container. They silently agreed to help each other move Marcellus to the bed. The droids hovered in and made him comfortable. We need to strap him down at least, Desi said. No, and if we did need to, I'm sure these two little guys will be there with the straps, Durkin said of the attendants, exiting the room with the gurney. Desi leaned over and gave Marcellus a kiss on the forehead of his air-inflated suit. She wanted to kiss his mouth, but that would have to be later. Unless he hated her for murdering him, which was likely. She wanted to cry again, had no idea what she'd gotten herself into, but put that emotion in a small space where she could ignore it until it came back to visit her later at a more appropriate time when nobody else was around. I don't know about you, Durkin said, pushing a small rod and making the gurney collapse into a cube. He slid the cube into its carrying pouch and tossed it on top of the blimp suit. But I'm ready to find out how our intrepid captain plans to get us away from the largest fleet in the Navy, especially now that we've killed their admiral. We've got a hard out, but I'm not sure how we get there. Ife does a good job shielding us, but not when everyone will want our heads. To the bridge? The bridge of the Lam Tin, no, Durkin had used its real name, the Apple of Discord, was a humble affair at the front of the ship near the nose. It held stations and seats for a dozen crew as well as logistics and cargo loaders. At present, only one person was on board. It was a woman with long, bleach blonde hair sitting at the stick. She was dabbing a kerchief to her eyes in a way that suggested she didn't want to muss up her makeup. She flicked a switch that activated the PA system. All hands secure for thrust, she said, as her voice echoed through the ship. Desi wondered how many people were on board the ship, but now was not the time to care. Desi started to sit in a seat for a quartermaster whose job would be to monitor cargo. She thought it was the seat least likely to be occupied at the moment. Oh no, the captain said. No, no, no. You are here with the second stick, she said, pointing to the co-pilot's seat. I finally get someone who knows how to fly a ship instead of steal things, kill things, and fix things. She's sure as shit not sitting in the back of the bus. The captain was tall with long arms and thin hands. She was very well appointed with large breasts and perfect makeup. She wore an odd take on a pilot's uniform from maybe World War II and was glamorous. She had a pistol that looked like a smaller version of the wicked thing Durkin wore on his leg. It was holstered on her belt, which held several magazines of ammunition and had a special place for a tube of ruby red lipstick. Desi sat in the co-pilot's seat. She expected to be officially welcomed on board by the captain or a representative, but that was the World Navy way. Instead, the captain grabbed Desi's hand with affection, looked her in the eyes, and asked, "Is there any pain, do you think?" The question was a non sequitur, but Desi caught up with it. No, none. It was instant. He was vaporized in a millisecond. He was very heroic. He saved my life, I think. Saved the mission. Good, the captain said. Good, good. She patted Desi's hands a few times and wiped the last of the tears from her face with a kerchief and tucked it in her bosom. Captain Bess, she said by way of introduction. Desi, Desi said, suddenly and primally jealous of Bess's good looks. Bess was quite beautiful, with a large mouth and piercing gray eyes. Her skin was the type of tan that suggested the Middle East or maybe Latina. Her hair was set in voluminous, perfectly coiffed victory rolls. The captain said, "Well, I should hope to shout. I don't know who else we'd have just picked up if it wasn't Desi." "Mr. Durkin," she said. "Ready, ma'am," Durkin said, strapping into the tactical station. "Let's do it," she said, and manually did the undock sequence from Echo Station. She fired some thrusters, and Desi felt a stronger burn than she had expected. The pressure pushed her back against the seat. They were really moving quite quickly. So much for not drawing attention to themselves. "Here we are," the captain said, as the Apple of Discord crawled toward the main body of Echo's combat fleet. "Escaping." The communication system issued a double tone that meant it was from a naval command vessel. It was a serious tone that made Desi reach for the stick. In her line as a fighter pilot, that sound meant orders were about to be countermanded and something more pressing had just come up on the battleground. And Desi was about to be ordered to take care of it. "This is the LCH Lam Tin," Bess said, with a bored lilt in her voice. "Lam Tin, make no further course adjustments, kill your thrust and prepare for boarding. You will be fired upon for failure to comply." Desi saw the threat indicator and saw no fewer than four Trickster-class fighter craft, her own type of craft, and two assault vehicles packed with Marines heading in their direction from the main fleet. She realized that with Echo in the middle of its transformation as it slowly sealed itself, no ships could be leaving it. All support would have to come from the fleet. That bought them time. Not much, but some time. Smart. A smirk crept over the captain's face as she activated the comm. "Naval Theater of Operations Echo. Lam Tin officially reporting in." She cut off the line as if something had gone wrong. "This is where they bare their teeth, dear," she said to Desi. Bess kept the ship accelerating and turned it away from the body of Echo. Desi knew what was next, and she watched the action screen to confirm it. One of the tricksters broke off from its formation and fired a series of bullets off the bow. One big, flashy burst with tracer rounds racing past them into the eternally ravenous belly of the void of space. Bess fiddled with her screens and sent a wash of noise over the comm unit. She said, "Wait for it." Desi knew the protocol. Next would be a missile detonated off the other bow. The second and final warning shot before they fired for effect. Desi watched the screen track the missile and heard the collision warning. It was a different sound than a missile lock, but not one that her pilot's instinct was happy with. Desi made sure her controls were locked down. They were. She put her feet on the pedals and moved the flight stick a couple of times just to see how it felt. She looked down to familiarize herself with trigger placement and weapon options, and of course, saw none. This was a light freighter. Bess made a strange half fist so she could look down at her fingernails. She was hamming it up, but Desi didn't think the performance was for her sake. It seemed like Captain Bess would be doing the same thing if she were alone on the deck, as if God were her constant audience. The captain said, "You know, even if all this chips a nail, I won't be mad at him. I'm in a desperate need of a manicure, combat or no combat." She looked down at Desi's nails and said, "It's glorious to have a girl on board. Maybe we can do each other's once we've got a night off." Her delivery made Desi blush. She thought the captain said "do each other" and misread the comment. Durkin said, "Detonation in 10. Where's Collis? Isn't this his job?" 4, 3, 2, 1. "Detonation," he said, as the apple of discord lurched from a near hit. At that very instant, Bess cut the engines and had an autopilot take over with a program. It enacted a single sideburn that set their ship spinning a bit as if it were out of control. The overall effect would be that it looked as if the missile did some damage and the ship was spinning. Bess said, "Okay, it's thin and it's tacky, but it'll buy us about 4 minutes and 20 seconds of them scanning, confirming, rescanning, and talking to whoever the hell the newly empowered Vice Admiral is before they blow us up or try to board us. Come on, sweetie, you want to see how we make our miraculous escape? I promise it will be mystifying in scope, it will drive Collis completely mental, and it will be simply dashing." They stood in the cargo bay nearest the Apple of Discord's bridge. It was dark and cool, and the glowing blue sigil on the ceiling was one that meant foodstuffs. It was a lie. The only thing in this cargo bay was a single G container. It was as far away from the bridge as it could have been and still been in the cargo hold. Upon approach, Desi noticed something on the ground. There was a ring of yellow spray paint on the flooring around the container. As they walked toward the paint line, she noticed some words painted on the floor a few feet away. "Unsafe zone. Do not bloody enter." Everyone ignored the caution and walked past the line, save Desi. Captain Bess crossed the yellow line first and moved to stand on a black square of metal about 1 inch high. She stood there for a few seconds, and suddenly the door to the container slid itself open. It was obviously some sort of security device or bioscanner, but unlike any Desi had seen on Earth or in the World Navy. Durkin walked past Desi, and once he crossed the yellow line, she did the same thing. She could have sworn she felt something, a static charge in the air maybe, but assumed she was giving herself the heebie-jeebies. The interior of the container was lined with panels of electronics that looked like towers of pre-war computer servers. They were comprised of modular pieces stacked together on black metal frames. They were on all sides of the container, even bolted to the door that swung open. In the center of the G container, sitting on the ground, was an orb about 4 feet across. It was a perfect sphere, black, in a dark container surrounded by black walls of equipment. "Here she is," Bess said. "Fucking thing. You could have warned me you were opening it," Collis said, suddenly standing behind them, lighting a bull moose pipe with a wooden match and smacking air into it to get the tobacco to catch. Desi started and even made a slight peep at Collis's presence. She felt, immediately, like an idiot. But the embarrassment hardly registered once the thought that someone would smoke on a space vessel raised so many alarms in Desi's brain that she didn't even know how to compose a reaction. Nobody else seemed to mind. Nobody else seemed to mind the impending attack that was just a few minutes away from the Apple of Discord either. Desi could palpably feel the weight of the incoming attack craft and two squads of Marines. If it were her at the stick of the trickster, she'd be pretty eager to go hot and have a firing solution registered by now. She could feel someone else ready to fire. Knowing fleet deployment, it would be either Lieutenant Nicholas Norris or Zachary Johnson heading this attack squad. Both good men. At a quick scan of the room, neither Bess, Durkin, nor Collis seemed to be worried in the slightest. Bess walked into the G-container and did an exaggerated wave over her shoulder to tell Desi to follow her in. Desi felt a gentle pressure on her wrist. It was Durkin's hand suddenly holding her. When she met his face, he stared down into her eyes with a fatherly countenance. He advised, "At some point, you're going to want to touch it. Do not." She nodded weakly, tired of the confusion, of the unknown elements of the plan, of death, of fleeing and lying and being around people who always seemed to know more than she did. "We'll explain all of this once we're gone from here," Durkin said, sensing her reticence. Desi asked, "And how do we get gone from here?" "This," Bess said from inside the dark container. Desi walked in and expected to be followed. Durkin stood outside as if on watch, and Collis hovered in the doorway, looking very much as if he were afraid of getting any closer to the orb. We call it a pinion engine, for no good reason, because actually, from what we can tell, this thing isn't an engine. It doesn't generate thrust or momentum. It's a pin. It sort of sticks us in place. "Which seems the opposite of making an escape," Collis said, sucking to get his pipe good and lit. Bess waved her hand in the air in front of her face to let Collis know the smoke was annoying and said, "Thank you, Mr. Collis." "Desi, as I'm sure you know, space and time are always moving. The galaxy spins at something like 480,000 miles per hour. And time, well, time moves like time moves. This thing, I'd call it an orb, but sometimes I don't think it is one, it pins the ship down, so space and time keep moving, but we technically stay in the same space and time." Bess had slid a screen and keyboard out of one of the black server towers. The interface on the screen seemed simple. Too simple. It had a bar that said duration, in which something could obviously be typed, and then there was a button on the screen that said pin. The pin button was grayed out, and Desi assumed it couldn't be used until a duration was entered. Bess continued, "What we intend to do is set it to pin us for just under a month." 565 hours, Collis said. 565 hours, yes. "This means time will progress without us in it. Space will move without us in it. Then we get unpinned, we'll just sort of not exist inside of normal space-time, and when we do get unpinned, we're back in space, and we'll have traveled something like 270 million miles. 29 AU, Collis said. Yes, 29 astronomical units. It'll bring us from way out here at the Kuiper Belt all the way to the terrestrial space, Desi said, realizing that this distance would bring them close to Earth or Mars or any of the rocky planets closest to the sun. Desi asked, "So we just kill time here in the ship for 24 days and then come back into space and time?" "Nope," said Bess. "Blink. Tempest fugit. We are there. We'll be outside of time. Don't ask me how the machine knows 24 days has passed if it isn't inside of time anymore, but it does. Shit, don't ask me anything about the machine at all. It was not designed by human minds. We don't even know what fuels it." "Evil thoughts on the souls of abused babies," Collis said from behind a puff of smoke. "A Razor class can barely reach those types of speeds," Desi observed. Collis said, "There is no speed, dearie. We're not here. There is no space. You can't track a transponder or detect engine burn. We quite simply don't exist when that thing is active." "With a device like that, the deviants should be dominating the world, Gov," Desi said. Bess said, "No, not at all, Desi. This is only one of three of them that I know of. The materials needed to make them are about as rare as anything in the solar system. Plus, it's only useful if you're going whatever direction the galaxy happens to be spinning. And yes, the universe is spinning as well, and the solar system is spinning and all the rest of it, but this device seems to only concern itself with the center of the Milky Way, like it's tuned to it or something. Bess typed in the number 565 into the duration box. Desi looked at the orb in the center of the dark room. She could see it better since the computer monitor was shedding light into this small space. Now the pinion engine was perfectly spherical, and it was perfectly black. She didn't think she'd ever seen something that could so completely absorb light waves as this thing did. And as she looked at it, she realized it wasn't an orb at all. It was in fact concave. It was a shell, and she could see the opening in the insides of the sphere. She moved her head for a slightly different angle, and no, it was an orb, fully enclosed. It was a bit maddening, and she knew all she needed to do was touch it to see if it was a full orb or if it had an opening. "It's got its hooks in her," Durkin said, breaking the spell. Desi stepped back and realized she was moments away from touching it. She backed out of the container and stood next to Collis, who looked over at her and nodded with his eyebrows as if to say he, too, thought the pinion engine was fucked up. "What's it feel like?" Desi asked of this seemingly impossible means of travel. Bess said simply, "This," and pushed the button to activate the pinion drive and unstick the Apple of Discord from the rest of time and space. So with that, we leave Desi, Marcellus, and the crew of the Apple of Discord as they begin a new journey unpinned in space and time. Just a couple of things to wrap up this particular issue. As always, if you like my writing, you can track down some of my other writings by going to mindframepodcast.com and go into the shop. My first book, 181 Pine, is there, as well as the books of Zachary Smith, so you can get that, or you can get any of our cool MindFrame merch that's out there, so it's worth looking into and checking out. Also, remember, we are a Podbelly original. If you go to podbelly.com, you can find other really cool podcasts such as Robots for Eyes and Art and Jacob Do America. They're not fictional podcasts like MindFrame, but they're really funny, really cool podcasts that are definitely worth giving a listen to. And as always, even if patronage isn't your bag and you want to save your hard-earned cash, there's another great way that you can support us, which is simply giving us share, giving us likes, joining the momentum in social media. So if you follow us or like our posts on Facebook, you can find us at MindFrame Podcast. If Twitter is your thing, you can find us at MindFrame Pod. And if you prefer Instagram, you can find us at The MindFrame Podcast. So give us a share, give us a like, give us a retweet, give us an upvote. It really helps the show to grow organically, and that's the best way for a show to grow. So thank you, as always, for listening. Tune in next time for another twist and turn in the story. And as always, remember, the Lariat is closing.